If you turn, please, to Psalm chapter 2, this will be our scriptural introduction for what we will do. This is a missions emphasis Sunday for us today. We'll be hearing later about God's work in a place like Albania. And this morning we'll hear about God's work past and present in another place. But I want to read Psalm 2. This is God's evaluation of the plans and responses of the nation to Him. So let me read it down through verse 8. Here is God looks at the earth. Even right now, God is in heaven, and this is His response. Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together for this purpose. They take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, against His Messiah, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. And here's God's response to that. But He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then He will speak to them in His wrath and terrify them in His fury, saying, as for me, the idea is, in spite of all your raging, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. And I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, here's God speaking to His Son, you are my Son. Today I have begotten you. And now this incredible statement from the Father to the Son, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. We'll stop there. But the Father says to the Son, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. In our worship time, we will see how God is making a place like Albania. Certainly it would have been the ends of the earth in the minds of those in Psalm 2. And then this morning, we're going to look at God's work, His promise to Christ is fulfilled, and His work that He does in a place like Burma, or modern-day Myanmar. That Burma is actually, what we'll read about today, is a fulfillment of the Father's promise to the Son, go ahead and ask for the ends of the earth, and I will give you peoples from the end of the earth. We sing that song, I think it's from O Church Arise, and there's a line in there that's one of my favorite where He talks about He gives to Christ an inheritance of nations. That's reflected right here in Psalm 2. Ask of me the nations of the earth, and I'll give you the ends of the earth for your inheritance. So this morning, and all morning, we want to look at God's fulfillment of His promise to the Son to give Him the ends of the earth for an inheritance. Well, 13 years ago, this past December, someone placed a copy of this book in my hands, To the Golden Shore. It's about a guy named Adoniram Judson. Interestingly enough, somebody gave me this book as payment for dropping them off in Atlanta, and I was dropped off in Atlanta. It was actually Janine's brother-in-law. He's a pastor in New Hampshire, and I had never driven a stick shift before. He said, I'll drive on the way there, and you'll drive it back. So I learned how to drive a stick, kind of, from the Atlanta airport on the way back. I almost ran over a few people in the speed bumps in the Atlanta airport because I wasn't going to stop once I got started. But this book came as payment for my taking him there. And I was a junior in college, and it was a splash of cold water on my heart. The book witnesses the life of the first missionary from America, Adoniram Judson. And 198 years ago this Friday, 198 years ago this Friday, Judson set sail from Salem, Massachusetts, aboard a ship called the Caravan on February 19th. Now, he was 25 years old. He'd been married just a week earlier. And he was heading to India. He'd eventually land in Burma, and he would spend the rest of his life there. Left at 25, newly married, first American missionary, and he was heading to India and eventually Burma, where he'd spend the rest of his life. The Golden Shore, Judson's life chronicles, here's what's interesting about his life and painful about his life is that it's just that his life is painful. His life is full of nothing but one wave of suffering after the next. But his life not only chronicles his suffering, but the sovereignty of God in the life of a man who suffered yet remained faithful. That's the story of Adoniram Judson's life. He suffered incredibly, yet he remained faithful. And God brought a nation, in a sense, to his knees. While languishing on his deathbed in a ship floating across the Indian Ocean, he groaned. I mean, you would think at the end of his life, maybe God would let up. This is the end of his life, and he's suffering. And he says, "How few there are who suffer such torment, who die so hard." Here's a summary. His 40-year ministry ended after he suffered the loss of 2 wives, 7 children, deep, prolonged despair, and endured 17 months in a Burmese death camp. And it's true that few have died so hard, but it's also true, and it's not rhetorical flourish, that few people have been so used, and I don't think that connection's accidental. He suffered greatly and was used greatly. That's what we're to expect as followers of Jesus. And through Adoniram, God stirred up an entire country of Buddhists and guaranteed a plentiful place for the Burmese people at the redemptive banquet table. That's Adoniram Judson's life in a nutshell. Now let's look at it more closely. I will use the 3 headings that Courtney Anderson does in this biography to the Golden Shore. He breaks his life down into 3 broad categories. He calls part 1 the embarkation from 1788 to 1812. Part 2 is the dangerous voyage from 1812 to 1826. And then part 3 is Judson reaches the Golden Shore 1826 to 1850. Along with this book, To the Golden Shore, it's been helpful. This is based off of a 2-volume book that's out of print. I think it's back in now. You can actually get 2 volumes as a Google book and read it online that way. But it's 2 volumes by a guy named Francis Wayland, who ended up being a president of the university that Judson did his undergraduate work in. But Francis Wayland wrote 2 books, and Anderson's work is based in large part off of that. There's also a little booklet called Adoniram Judson and the Missionary Call. You can find that on the internet as well, and that was helpful in preparing this. So if you would see this, what I've tried to do is to use as much first person. You'd see lots of quotes here, but I'm obviously not going to stop and say footnote page so-and-so. But just so you know, full disclosure, those are the 3 things that have gone into this. So let's look at part 1, the embarkation, 1788 to 1812. This cover obviously Adoniram's birth, his upbringing in the home of a congregational minister. He was from a Christian family, congregational home. It covers his courtship and marriage, and then his departure to Burma with a missionary team that went with him. He was born on August 9, 1788. That was the same year that Charles Wesley died. John Wesley died a few years later in 1791. William Carey, the missionary to India, the father of modern missions, Protestant missions anyway, he set sail for India in 1793. So that's just a few years after Adoniram Judson is born. Going on in America, you have lots of states, Georgia, South Carolina, who are ratifying the Constitution, becoming an official part of the United States. So that's kind of what's going on in Europe and here in a very small way. Judson was a man of gifted intellect. His mother taught him to read at the age of 3. During the years of his boyhood, he read everything he could lay his hands on, from his father's religious books to Ben Jonson's plays to the novels of the bestsellers of his time. By the time he was 10 and in grammar school, his reputation for mathematics had extended into language, into Greek and Latin. As a young child, he wrote and solved riddles for a magazine, mathematics, puzzles and riddles, and was sought on to give and answer these kinds of things as a young boy, and he even eventually wrote his own textbook, which was used in the area. He entered Brown University, or Brown College, 6 days after his 16th birthday, and he was so advanced that he was allowed to skip his freshman year, enter as a sophomore, so he completed a 4-year degree in 3 years. He delivered the valedictorian address I'm pretty sure it was given at the First Baptist Church in Providence, Rhode Island. You can visit the church today, stand where Judson delivered that valedictorian address in Providence, Rhode Island. So he was a man of gifted intellect. Will show up later in the translation work that he did. He was also a man of troubled faith and remarkable conversion. He goes off to university, the home of a minister, and the whole time he has these doubts about his father's faith. He goes off to Brown University, and he now has this kind of figuratively continental experience. Now he's exposed to a variety of ideas and philosophies. He comes under the influence of a fellow student named Jacob Eames. Eames is a convinced rabid, you could say, rabid deist, and it destroys Adoniram Judson's faith. Interestingly, reading the biography of Ben Franklin, it says he threw off his Calvinistic heritage as well for deism. So it was kind of going on that time, and he does so. At his 20th birthday, he announces to his parents, this is what he says, "I cannot believe the Bible is anything but the work of men, any more than the Quran or the sacred writings of Buddha." Now that would be ironic, because in the mysterious providence of God, he would go to a country of Buddhists to tell them about Jesus. But at 20 years old, the Bible's no different than Buddha. And even Jesus, he was certainly the Son of Man, but almost as certainly not the Son of God, except in the sense that all men are. So here he's broken the hearts of his parents and thrown off his faith. And 6 days later, he decides he wants to try out for a career in playwriting and theater in New York. So he packs his bags and he heads to New York to do what people do today, to go find meaning, significance in life in New York and all the big city has to offer. But he grew tired of that. And soon he was not only disillusioned with God, but with life altogether, which is just an interesting aside that the grass isn't greener outside of the church. You have the same existential questions outside of the church as inside of the church. And Judson found it was true. So he's really is aimlessly wandering. And he spends the night at an inn, and he hardly sleeps a wink that night. And here's how Judson and Courtney Anderson describes that night. "He found a room in a local inn. He stabled his horse and asked the innkeeper for a room. The house was nearly full, said the landlord, but he had one room next to a young man who was critically ill, perhaps dying, who might be a disturbance to him. But Adoniram said he would not let a few noises next door deny him a night's rest. So after having something to eat, the landlord showed Adoniram to his room and left him. And without further ado, Adoniram got into bed and waited for sleep to come. And as soon as he did, the noises and moanings from the next room began. They were not very loud, but there were footsteps coming and going, a board creaking, low voices, and groans and gasps. These did not disturb him unduly, not even the realization that a man might be dying, because death was commonplace in Adoniram's New England. It might come to anyone at any age. What disturbed him was the thought that this man in the next room might not be prepared for death, and he wondered if he himself was. So he tosses and turns all night listening to this moaning and wondering about death. And then he thinks about midnight. He says, what would the classmates at Brown say to my terrors of the night who thought of me as bold and fought? Above all, what would Eames say, that clear-headed, skeptical, witty, and talented friend? He imagined Eames' laughter, felt some shame, and drifted off to sleep. He woke the next morning, and all of the impressions he had from the night before started to fade away. He starts to make his payment at the desk, and he asks casually whether the man in the next room was better. He is dead, was the answer. Adoniram was taken back. There was a heavy finality to the word dead. For an instant, some of the fear of that night made itself felt once more. Adoniram stammered out a few conventional phrases common to humanity when death takes someone nearby, and he asked the inevitable question, well, do you know who he was? Oh, yes. He was a young man from the college in Providence. His name was Eames, Jacob Eames. In the mysterious providence of God, Jacob Eames had destroyed Judson's faith and had been instrumental in Judson's conversion to Christ. Judson was a man of dedicated passions, gifted intellect, troubled faith, and gifted passions. Now, he moved back home with his parents, and he enrolled at a new seminary getting started called Andover Seminary. Judson's father had been instrumental in helping to start it as this one writer says, an orthodox Calvinistic response to the liberalism coming out of Harvard. He met up with some sympathetic students to missions, one of whom was a guy named Samuel Mills. Andover started in 1807. In August of 1806, five students gathered outside at Williams College to meet to pray regarding missions. That meeting was broken up by a thunderstorm, and I don't know what possessed them to do this, but they found shelter underneath of a haystack. Now, there they determined that they would pledge themselves to foreign missions. Thunderstorm, hiding under hay. Now, many people view the haystack prayer meeting, it's what it's called, the haystack prayer meeting as the beginning of missions in America, the missions movement in America. Now, Mills transferred from Williams College, went to Andover Seminary, and in the providence of God, he and Mills meet. And until he meets Mills, Judson is convinced, I am the first and only student dedicated to foreign missions. What that means is that Judson's decision for missions wasn't riding a wave of bandwagon emotionalism and fervor to go do something cool like that. He wasn't the only one thinking about missions, but he was one of the only ones thinking about missions. He was a man of dedicated passions. Now, he shares this with his family. And his family resists him a bit. Why should you throw yourself away among the ignorant savages who can never appreciate you half a world from home? Think how much good he could be in Boston. There are souls to save in New England, too. Of course, Judson was saddened by this, but he was undeterred, and he kept talking about missions until he had his own band of small missions movement there at Andover Seminary. But he was passionate about more than missions. Chapter 10 is called A Wild Romantic Undertaking and is lifted from his wife's own journals as she looks back on the situation. It's hard to know what to be taken back more by. Judson's pursuit of Anne Nancy Hasseltine, I don't know the I and the E at the end, whatever. It's Nancy Ann, whatever her name. How do you say the end? Or his bold pursuit of her, or his bold pursuit of Burma. Here's what he writes. He's asking for her hand in marriage, and this is the kind of letter he writes to his potential father-in-law. Right? I don't think any of you would ever do this. I now have to ask you whether you can consent to part with your daughter early next spring to see her no more in this world. Whether you can consent to her departure and her subjection to the hardships and sufferings of the missionary life. Whether you can consent to expose her to the dangers of the ocean, the fatal influence of the southern climate of India, to every kind of want of distress, to degradation, insult, persecution, and perhaps a violent death. Can you consent to all this for the sake of him who left his heavenly home and died for her and for you, for the sake of perishing immortal souls, for the sake of Zion and the glory of God? Can you consent to all this in hope of soon meeting your daughter in the world of glory, not this world, but that next world with the crown of righteousness, brightened with the acclamations of praise which shall redound to her Savior from heathen saved through her means from eternal woe and despair? Can you consent to this? This is what I'm asking. Now, people obviously heard about that kind of bold, please let me marry your daughter speech. And they thought Judson was nuts. People even said that if that were my daughter, I'd tie her to a bedpost and never let her leave. Well, her parents were more cautious and left the decision up to her own choosing. This is her response. She journals her response. Jesus is faithful. His promises are precious. And were it not for these considerations, I should, with my present prospects, sink down in despair, especially as no female has, to my knowledge, ever left the shores of America to spend her life among the heathen. Nor do I yet know that I shall have a single female companion. But God is my witness, that I have not dared to decline that offer that has been made me, though so many are ready to call it a wild, romantic undertaking." That is quite a lady. Well, things moved rather quickly. They were married February the 5th. The next day, Judson was ordained with some of his friends at the Tabernacle Church in Salem. They still have the pew there where those men sat, laid hands were laid on them. February 19th, he set sail aboard the brig Caravan with Luther Rice, Samuel Newell, and Harriet Newell, and of course his own wife. So the dangerous embarkation had begun. He was gifted intellect, troubled faith, dedicated passions, and the journey was just starting. Part two is this dangerous voyage from 1812 to 1826. He first endures a baptism of water. On the voyage from America, Judson busied himself. He busied himself in this about 114-day trip. So this isn't even a 12-hour flight from one spot to the next. 114 days, and he busies himself with translation work from the Greek New Testament. During his translation work of the Greek New Testament, Judson says that he is convinced that the immersion of a professing believer is the only Christian baptism. Now, that's significant because both he and his wife were from a congregational heritage, which means they were sprinkled as infants as part of the covenant community. Now, Judson's translating the Bible, and he's saying, that's not right. So as a result, he and his wife are baptized when they arrive in Calcutta, India, in September of 1812. That doesn't seem like a big deal. Except when you consider this, that decision cost them every penny of support that they had. They absolutely lost all financial prayer support that they had. Because the Congregational Mission Board had to give them up. Once again, his wife wrote this, how difficult that was. "The most terrifying circumstances attending this change, and that which has caused us most pain, is the separation which must take place between us and our dear missionary associates. We feel that we are alone in the world, with no real friend but each other, no one on whom we can depend but God." Shortly after their baptism, Judson had situated himself with William Carey for a time, and Carey heard Judson's sermon on baptism, and William Carey declared it at the time the best sermon on baptism that I had ever heard, but this decision was costly to them. And then he endured a baptism of suffering, and we'll pause here for a moment and just think of all that he endured. The first hardship affected Judson's deeply but indirectly. Harriet Newell was 19 years old. She was newly married, and she died, and so did her newborn child. It left them all asking this: where was the purpose of Providence in this mean, sneaky, even vindictive attack on a young mother and a newborn baby? That's the kind of question that they would wrestle with again and again throughout the entirety of their ministry. Sailing from India to Burma, Judson's wife Nancy went into labor. She had no physician but Mr. Judson. The baby was born dead and buried at sea. Their second child, Roger, didn't fare much better. For 6 months, he waxed fat and healthy. Then in the early March of 1816, Nancy began to notice that he was feverish and perspired heavily at night. He wouldn't last, and he was buried under a circle of mango trees. At that point, Nancy, Judson's wife, noted again, "Our hearts were bound up with his child. We felt he was our earthly all, our only source of innocent recreation in this heathen land. But God saw it was necessary to remind us of our error and to strip us of our only little all. And may it not be vain that he has done it. May we so improve that he will stay his hand and say to us, it is enough." Now, added to the loss of his children, Judson endured 17 excruciating months in a death camp for being a spy. He was an American, but the government in Burma grew greatly suspicious of the British activities and this association, so Judson was rounded up for being a spy on behalf of the British. He was put in this death camp. It was run by former criminals. And at night, their feet were bound to a rod. They were suspended upside down so that only their head and their shoulders touched the ground. And every day the doors would open and one prisoner would be dragged out and executed. And every day, Adoniram Judson lived under that kind of deadly suspense. The door opens, am I next? Those who didn't die at the hands of the executioners entered death through starvation and raging fever and sickness. The only thing that kept Judson alive was daily visits from his wife, Anne. She often came with food and spent all of her time meeting his needs. During this time, she gave birth to their third child, a little girl named Maria. She grew sick from her daily visits. Her milk dried up, and she went from person to person in her village begging for someone to nurse her newborn little girl. And all of this, it appears that she had come down with cerebral meningitis. There's a beautiful tribute that Francis Whalen writes to Anne Judson during this time. This is what he says: "If it had not been for an angel ministering to him, Adoniram Judson would not have survived. Mrs. Judson must be designated as one of the most remarkable women of her age. She was the only female European in Ava, the city in Burma, and the only foreigner not consigned to prison. Her whole time, with the exception of 20 days, when she was confined by the birth of her child, was devoted to the alleviation of the sorrows of her husband and of his fellow prisoners. She was perfectly familiar with the Burmese language, a presence which commanded respect from savage barbarians and encircled with the moral atmosphere in which she walked unharmed in the midst of a hostile city with no earthly protector. She was universally spoken of as the guardian angel of that band of sufferers." This is almost two stories: Judson's faith and Anne's faith. Upon his release, December 31st, 1825, Judson hurried home to his own house. And here's how Anderson records the event. He entered his home. He leaned over a motionless figure, and he could hardly believe his eyes. But it was Nancy. But he wasn't sure if she was dead or alive. His breath on her cheek must have fanned some remaining vitality, for she opened her eyes. She was alive. She was still alive, and just barely. They enjoyed 10 more months together, and then she died. And 6 months later, Maria died. Then, in July, Adoniram received word that his father had died the previous November. That same year, Adoniram wrote to his sisters-in-law, "Death mocks us and tramples our dearest hopes and our lives to the dust. Dreadful tyrant, offspring and ally of sin. But go on now and do your worst. Your time will come. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Yes, all for power, you will devour yourself and die. And then my angelic Anne, my meek blue-eyed Roger, and my tender-hearted, affectionate darling Maria, they shall be rescued from the power of death in the grave, and we know assuredly that we shall die no more. We shall make heaven's arches ring with songs of praise to him who has loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood." Now, you'll see this in just a moment, but Judson was a very disciplined, hardworking, type A, don't sleep, eat little personality. That type of personality can often run roughshod over a family, as if you're just my maid or something. But there were several who observed that Judson was one of the most tender, affectionate husbands they had ever seen. So he endured a baptism of suffering, and he endured a baptism of ministry. From his arrival, Adoniram wanted to be the one to provide a Burmese Bible. Not simply one among many, he wanted to provide the Burmese people with their scriptures. This was his reasoning. there would have to be a Burmese Bible before the Burmese people could become Christian. And by July 12th of 1823, he completed his translation of the entire New Testament, and he'd written a summary of the Old Testament in 12 sections. That was one of the concerns during his imprisonment, was he and his wife both thought the translation work had been lost and stolen and thrown away. But Anne had, she had smuggled it into a pillow and sewed it up, and it made it safe through the ordeal. God not only granted his desire to see the New Testament translated, but also his desire to see sinners converted. After six long back-breaking years, Adoniram saw his first convert, Maung Nau, and baptized him on Sunday, June 27th, 1819, and Adoniram prayed on that occasion, "May it prove the beginning of a series of baptisms in the Burmese Empire, which shall continue in uninterrupted succession until the end." The dangerous embarkation had ended. The dangerous voyage was almost over. He has endured a baptism of water, suffering, and ministry, and now to the Golden Shore, 1826 to 1850. Judson saw his heart. This is towards the end of his life. We're going to go back now a little to the suffering, because what you heard was almost, really? It sounds like he responded gracefully, but almost unbelievably to his suffering. Now we're going to see he saw his heart, and it wasn't all that way. The first two chapters of Anderson's book in part three detail the agonizing journey that Judson took through deep and prolonged depression. It reminds me of the treatment Jeremiah the prophet received. After years of faithfulness in a hostile environment, here's how you sum up Jeremiah's life in Jeremiah 38:6. They took Jeremiah, threw him into the cistern, and he sank down into the mud. Thank you, God. What really seemed to be the catalyst for his dark days was a sudden awareness of self-ambition. And it's hard to know how much of this is true or how much is over-introspection on Judson's part. But this is the catalyst, anyway, that really pushes him over the edge into darkness. He begins to suspect that his real motive in becoming a missionary had not been genuine humility and self-abnegation, but ambition. I wanted to be the first American foreign missionary. I wanted to be the first missionary to Burma, the first translator of the Bible into Burmese, first in my own eyes and first in the eyes of men. Now that pushed him over to the edge, and whatever term, psychologically, spiritually, you want to use, he broke down. He lost it. He sought to mortify everything in his life that had to do with pride. He wrote a curt letter to Brown University rejecting the honorary doctorate that had been given to him 5 years earlier. He destroyed all letters of accolade and commendation from the British Empire. He had accumulated considerable sum of money by his life savings and gifts given to him, and he wrote to the mission board and gave it all back for the cause of missionary endeavor. He was so much in darkness, he decided to give up all of his activity in life, and he went deep into the jungle, built a bamboo hut, dug a grave, and he waited to die and fall into it. And he imagined his body at varying stages of decay as he was deep in the jungle by the grave, waiting to die. Those who knew him were so concerned that he was so deep in the jungle that the part he was in was tiger infested, and nobody came out of that part of the jungle alive. And he was spending now 40 days he spends there. Those natives regarded that place as so dangerous that they believed Judson's survival was a repetition of the miracle of Daniel. He spent 40 days in seclusion there, eating only small rations of rice. And slowly, the darkness lifted. And Judson finally started to see a harvest. God heard Judson's prayer at the baptism of that first convert, and he used Judson's faithfulness through suffering to bring in a harvest of souls. It had taken Adoniram and Nancy 9 years to baptize 18 converts. But in the first 5 years, after his imprisonment, after the war, He was to report within a few months that 242 Burmese people had been baptized, plus 113 foreigners. From the beginning of 1831, the total number of baptisms at the end of that year stood at 373, of which 217 had been made in that year. Another author puts this in perspective and says that 18 were baptized from 1892 to 1822, but beginning with 1828, after his release from prison, after his wife dies, he suffered the loss of two of his kids and his co-workers. After 1828, there's a marked increase. In 1836 alone, 1,144 were baptized. Once again, I want us to see that connection is no accident. There is a connection between the sufferings of God's people and the success of the gospel. That's Judson's life. It's what Jesus himself said, unless a corn of wheat fall to the ground and it die, it abides alone. Except a corn of wheat fall to the ground and die, it abides alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. There is an undeniable connection between Judson's suffering and the success of the gospel. Immediately, almost immediately after his own darkness lifted, he endured imprisonment, death, disease. God starts to shine the light of the gospel in Burma. And finally, Judson sees the golden shore. But it's not like he suspected. I think somebody looking back on it, I don't know if this is true or not, that he dies of something like consumption and they had no idea what to do with it then. I don't know. Whatever it was, the cure was get in the ship and go in the middle of the sea and maybe the fresh air will help you. But it made it worse for him. Aboard the sailing vessel, the captain gave an order. The coffin slid through the port into the night. The location was latitude 13 degrees north, longitude 93 degrees east, almost in the eastward shadow of the Andaman Islands and only a few hundred miles west of the mountains of Burma. At 15 minutes after 4 on Friday afternoon, April 12, 1850, Adoniram Judson had finally reached the Golden Shore. Well, let me just bring some things together here from his life. Today, his legacy lives on in the Karen people. The Karen people are the people that responded most to Judson's gospel with the help of another Karen tribesman that was converted. And to see how all this snakes together, it was one of the Karen people who showed up with James Frazier in China to help him reach people. All connected back to Adoniram Judson's faithful ministry. Just this week, I've read this book twice, back in 96-97, and then I read it 2 years ago at the beach, which is, wow. You're going to talk about something like, why am I here at the beach reading this? And it definitely helped keep things in perspective. Like, this is not all that there is. So I started trying to do more research on the Karen people. And about that time, I'm not telling you to go watch it, but the last Rambo movie came out. And it centered around the Karen people in Burma. And at the end, I was mesmerized that there was a whole human rights group who were going after the support and protection of the Karen people who are suffering at the hands of the Burmese government. They're trying to be wiped out systematically. I couldn't believe, then this Hollywood film, and here's the Karen people, I'm thinking, that's Judson's people there. Just this week, on the Gospel Coalition blog, there was a post about the persecuted church in Burma. Adoniram Judson and Ko Ta Bu, the Karen apostle, brought the gospel to the Karen people in 1828. Revival came and thousands from this animistic people were saved and baptized. Now, 40% of the Karen people are Christian. They're suffering and they need our prayers. Christians receive harsh treatment in Burma, also known as Myanmar, where they make up only 4% of the population. 89% are Buddhist. According to a report from Compass Direct, printing of Bibles is restricted and churches are destroyed on a regular basis. Last January, 100 churches in Rangoon, that's where Judson started in the capital, were forced to close. If a Karen Christian wants a job or promotion, they're often told to convert to Buddhism first. But the persecution goes far beyond closing churches and discriminatory hiring practices. Over 150 Karen and Kareni people have fled to refugee camps in Thailand, and over half of them are Christians, descendants of Judson. They were forced to flee their homeland by the repressive Burmese military, which has burned to ground hundreds of villages, killed thousands of their own people, and put many more to work in death camps. The military carries out much of its violence under the pretext of stamping out rebel activity, but it seems many are seeking to crush Christianity as well. Voice of the Martyrs tells of a Burmese official who recently stated, quote, "Soon there will be no Christians in this nation. You will only be able to see a Karen person in a picture in a museum." The persecution has been going on for many years. This is an especially precarious time for many of our Burmese brothers and sisters. The Thai government is threatening to force Burmese refugees back into Burma in the next couple of weeks, where most would be tortured, raped, or killed. Many other Burmese Christians are hiding in the Burmese jungle. One mission network tells of 100 Karen children in hiding in the jungle. And a group called Vision Beyond Borders is working hard to serve these children and other displaced Burmese Christians. And then it mentions a helpful 30-day prayer guide that you can download to learn more, pray, spread the word for our brothers and sisters in Burma who are the result of Adoniram enduring suffering himself. Just a few things here at the end. I think it's instructive to learn Judson's method of missions. I want to point that out because we're going to hear a method of missions later on from David Hasselfluke, and I want you to key in on how complex his method of missions is. You listen for how complex it is. Here's Judson's. Judson's goal was, here he was going to an unreached people group. And his goal was this: preaching and church planning followed by the immediate recognition, training, and equipping of pastors. Now that doesn't seem like a big deal, but it stands in slight contrast to William Carey. William Carey's threefold approach was preach the gospel, translate the Bible, and establish schools. And the mission schools did a variety of subjects, all helpful and needful, but Judson emphasized a bold advance of the gospel by preaching, gathering converts, and church planning, and then as he discipled, he sent them out two by two. I say that because there are lots of things that people can get excited about under the banner of missions, but Judson shows us it's possible to reach an unreached people group by keeping it simple if you're willing to suffer. Number two, prayer. We probably could say that the work in Burma stems from the Haystack prayer meeting in 1806. In his diary for November 10th, he wrote, "This evening, 1819, is the first date of the first Burmese prayer meeting that was ever held. None present but myself and three converts. We agree to meet for this purpose every Tuesday and Friday evening, immediately after family worship." And 4 days later, Judson is thrilled because he finds out they're meeting on their own, having a prayer meeting. Church planning, prayer, and the language. I think it's obvious that not everybody's going to be as talented as Judson is. By the time he's done, he does translate the entire Bible into the Burmese language. And my understanding is it's still used today. You can Google Adoniram Judson and found all this. He wrote a grammar that's still used today. His Bible is still used today. It's the standard work, standard translation. And not everybody will have the same proficiency and skill, but it seems to me that teams going in this type of area ought to be concerned about Judson's thing. They will never become Christian without the Christian scripture. so that when they leave, this is there. And it seems that based on their own lives, that somebody ought to give himself or herself to intense learning of the culture and language. It relates to the manner of their missions. They weren't the first ones into Burma. There were two others who preceded them, short time, little success. Felix Carey, William Carey's son, was there when Judson arrived, and they had a big missions complex shelter set up in Rangoon, where he stayed for a while. It was great for intense language training. It was great for that. But Judson and his wife wanted to be closer to the people, and there was no way you were going to get people just to kind of stop in at the missions compound. So they wanted to think of a way to engage people. So he looked around and found out there's the shelter, Z-A-Y-A-T, a Zayat open shelter that looks like a picnic. You see pictures of it, it looks like a picnic shelter at a pavilion, at a park. It's raised on these big rafters and this platform, and people climb in. Travelers would climb in, sit there and talk, or Buddhists would use it to discuss religion with people as they came along the way. Judson sees that. He's not intimidated with the association with Buddhism and says, I'm going to do that. So 5 years after arriving, he builds a 20 by 20 Zayat, and the results are almost immediate as far as people stop in. That's what they do. So they stop in, and he starts engaging them in conversation. He even visited a few of the Buddhist services in these Zayats to get a form for how their service flows, and then he adopted it himself as much as he could. So much so that everybody who came after him thought the way to get the Burmese people was to build Zayats. Rather than continuing to read the environment and scan what's the best way, we'll just do that again. Well, here's a brutal letter. Two more things. He writes in January 12, 1833, and on behalf of all the missionaries serving in Burma, he protests against people sending short-term missionaries whom he regarded as hirelings. This is his observation. Again, this is a dude who suffered. This is what he writes. They are all good for nothing. Though brilliant in an English pulpit, they are incompetent to any real missionary work. They come out for a few years with a view of acquiring stock credit on which they may vegetate the rest of their days in the congenial climate of their own native land. As to lessening the trials of the candidate for missions and making the way more smooth before him, it is just what ought not to be done. Missionaries need more trials on their first setting out instead of less. You need to suffer more early than less, is what he says. The motto of every missionary, whether preacher, printer, or schoolmaster, ought to be devoted for life. A few days earlier, he quotes a brother who was asked by a Burmese officer of government how long you intend to stay. His reply promptly, until all Burma worships eternal God. To me, that's the summary of Judson's life. Until all of Burma worships the eternal God. Now, obviously, he's not saying that out of ease, an air-conditioned building, and the man suffered immensely. Which makes me want to conclude like this. In Psalm 2, we're told, "You are my son, ask of me, I'll make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession." My question is, how did the Father grant that request for the Son? How did the nations of the earth and the ends of the earth become the Son's inheritance? And it was through the suffering of the cross. And if it's that way for the Son, if it's that way for the Son, and we're followers of the Son, it will be no different for us. Now, the reason why one reads any biography is for inspiration and not imitation. I think we see from Judson's life that we see God's triumph in Burma through Judson's faith, while not glossing over his struggles. The result is that I would want to leave us from, when I read this book, there's a tendency to be depressed, but I don't want to leave us despairing because we're not Adoniram Judson, but I want us to be inspired to trust the same God to do the similar things that he did for Judson. Isn't that the point of Hebrews 11? The point isn't be like these people in their exploits, but be like these people in their faith in God. through faith. Listen again, friends. You've heard it before. Listen again now through the lens of Judson's life. Through faith, they conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, and put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release that they might rise again to a better life. But all of this is through faith. It won't be easy. It can cost us everything. And I simply commend to you Judson's life and his suffering as a paradigm, an example for the way that the gospel will continue to make bold advances today. His life epitomizes until all of Burma worships the eternal God, and he will embrace the sufferings of Christ for the glories that will follow.